Well, on behalf of the Mexican American Politics class, I would like to thank Ms. Rose Herrera for joining us today. And today is Tuesday, January 28th, 2003, and we will be interviewing Ms. Herrera at the University of Texas at Arlington in University Hall. And this interview will contain three parts. First, biographical information, then political career, and last, your views and opinions. The interview will be conducted by myself, Brooke Abella, and also Marcella Flores, Penny McCain, and soon will be joined by Andrew Hill.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And first, I'll start off with some biographical information. And first thing is, where was Ms. Herrera born? When and where?
I was born August the 20th, 1954, in Gonzales, Texas. And Gonzales is about 90 miles southeast of San Antonio.
Okay, is that where you grew up as a child?
No, actually my family moved to Fort Worth in 56. I mean, I came as a young child, and I've lived in Fort Worth ever since.
Okay, now let's talk a little bit about your family. Can you tell us who your parents are?
My dad was Cleofas Castro Olmos. My mom, Pauline Guerra. He was from Piedras Negras, Mexico, and my mom was from Seguin, Texas.
Okay, and can you give us the names of your grandparents, both on your mother's and father's side?
My mom's dad was Plutarco Guerra, and my mom's mom was Andrea Guerra.
And are they from Texas, or are they from Mexico?
Texas.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what about your father's side?
My father, and all I know is that his mom's name was Teresa, okay. Teresa Castro, and I never got to meet, you know, his parents on his side.
Well, I'm assuming they were in Mexico. They were.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
All right. And do you have any children?
Yes, I do. I have two children.
Their names?
Shane Herrera, Albert Shane Herrera, and Monica Elaine Herrera.
Okay, so I'm assuming you have a husband.
Yes, I have a husband. Yeah, I have a husband, and actually we will be married 30 years next month. His name is Albert Herrera.
And then he's originally from
Texas? He's originally from Fort Worth.
Fort Worth, mm-hmm. Okay. And about your children, were they raised here in Fort Worth?
Yes, they were.
Okay. And do they have any children?
Yes. Well, my daughter is single, and my son is married, and he has four children.
Four children. Okay, and do you have any siblings, brothers and sisters?
Yes, actually, I'm the youngest of 11.
Wow. how many brothers and how many?
There's six girls and five boys.
Five boys.
And two are deceased, so there's, you know, the rest are five. There's still the five girls and then the four boys.
Okay, do you mind naming all of them?
No. The oldest one was Teresa Olmos, and then let me see if I get them in age order here. Teresa Olmos, Pete Olmos, Carmen Olmos Cruz, Zenaida, call her Sandy. Sancho is her last name now, and then I have Cleofas Olmos Jr. And then there is Raymond Olmos, Joe Olmos, Danny Olmos, he's one that's deceased, Mary Mendez, and Angie Guerrero. And I think that's it, myself.
Now, could you tell us a little bit about your childhood in Fort Worth?
My childhood in Fort Worth? Just the norm. Nothing, no thrills, no frills, nothing like that. You know, we come from a very modest, you know, family. My father passed away when I was four, and one of the things that he instilled in my mom is the fact that whenever we were playing or anything like that, that we had to play in our own yards. We had no business being down a neighbor's house or whatever, so it was very, very strict. My biggest thing and the thing that I loved to do the most was play with Jacks. That was my thing, and I thought I was pretty good at it. You know.
Could you tell us what your father did for work to support such a large family?
Just really basically anything and everything. Mostly he was a hauler. You know, he hauled. He had a big truck, and he hauled, you know, gravel and things of that nature, dirt and soil.
Okay. And what about your mother? Did she?
My mother was always a stay-at-home mom, always.
Okay.
And to this day, she has. My mom is 90 years old. She's still alive, and she has never worked a day out of the house. She never remarried. When my father passed away, she never remarried, and she's still well.
That's good. Could you tell us where you went to elementary school?
I went to elementary school at Sam Rosen Elementary in Fort Worth, on the north side of Fort Worth.
All right, and what about junior high?
Junior high, I went to J.P. Elder Middle School, or actually it was junior high at that time. It's now a middle school.
How about high school?
High school, I went to Northside High School for 1 year, and that was in 1969. That was the first year the Fort Worth Independent School District decided to try out a pilot program to see how the ninth graders would fare in the high school. And so we had no choice but to go into Northside. So I went to Northside for 1 year, and because my older brothers and sisters were going to Trimble Tech, as soon as I had the opportunity, I transferred out and went to Trimble Tech High School, graduated from Trimble Tech.
Okay, and how about, did you attend any college?
The only thing that I've done is non-credit courses, took some insurance courses. My area is personal injury law, and at the time it was workers' comp, so I took a workers' comp and a personal injury class, you know, liability class. And I attended numerous conferences in the legal field, you know, through Trial Lawyers Association and things of that nature, and Metal Legal Institute, things that would assist me in processing claims.
Okay. And what experiences have you had in your life that have caused you to be so active within your community?
Actually, being active started when my son was in elementary school. Got involved with the PTA, you know, just trying to help the teachers and do whatever we could do, and volunteering in the office and so forth. And it all started from there, and continued, you know, even with my younger daughter, and into the high school. And of course, the only thing that one of the things that I regret is when my daughter was in high school, I was fully involved. Actually, I was involved with the board when my son was in high school, but with my daughter, because of the issues that were going on, it took up a lot more of my time than when I first got on. And so I didn't have the opportunity to volunteer as much with my daughter in high school like I did with my son. And then there was always the problem of the teachers not being able to accept you as a parent. You know, I was always wearing the hat as a board member, and it's like, oh, there's a board member, you know, that type of thing. So that's a regret that I harbor, is the fact that I couldn't be a regular parent with my daughter, you know, with the teachers. You know, they couldn't handle that.
Not to get a little bit personal, what religion do you follow?
Catholic.
You're Catholic. Mm-hmm. From both sides of your family?
Yes.
And now, well, I'm going to hand over the rest, a few more questions from Marcella Flores.
I'll be doing the political career part. Can you tell us what influenced you to enter politics?
Again, as I stated earlier, I was very involved with PTA, and at the high school level, with my son, because I became so active, the principal at the high school, at Northside High School at that time, was Mauro Serrano, and he asked me to, at the time they started doing the site-based management team, and so he said, Ms. Herrera, can you serve on the site-based management team, which it's a team where it's the principal, teachers, parents, and students, you know, kind of try to see what things will work best for the schools and what won't. And so I served on that, and then I became like the president of the baseball booster club because they didn't have a booster club. So it was just, whenever the principal needed something, so well, ask Ms. Herrera, see if she'll do it, or ask her, see if she'll do it. And little did I know that what he was doing all along was training me for the future of politics, and I didn't realize. I was just doing because it needed to be done, and we didn't have the support, you know, from some of the family members, actually the parents. We didn't have some of the support, so when the position came up about school board, he says, well, you're ready, and I'm like, for what? And he says, well, you know, there's going to be a vacancy on the school board, and I think that you ought to try it. And no intentions ever to get into this arena. None whatsoever. That was not something I aspired to do.
And so is there one person that you would say influenced you into the politics?
He was very instrumental. I had several people that I knew in the legal field that asked me to do that. And I guess most of the credit I have to give it to my husband, because he was the one that said, you know, you're always saying that people need to step up and try to, voice their concerns and fight for other people, and so here's your opportunity. And so I would have to give him, I don't know if I should give him credit or if I should be mad at him.
And would you mind telling us, do you have any partisan affiliation? Is there any political party you belong to, or?
Most of my life it's been Democrat. Most of my life has been Democrat.
And can you tell us some of the organizations that you're a member of and that you founded as well?
I've been on a lot of organizations. One of the things that I'm very proud of is the fact that I'm one of the co-founders of the Centro Cultural de las Americas. And that's a program that we have, it's an after-school program that the fine arts for children, our latchkey kids that, go home and there's no one at home to watch them. And so we created those programs in order to give them a little bit of a diversion, and not to be home after school either. And so I'm very proud of that. I've served on numerous boards, from a gang task force to been appointed by the mayor of Fort Worth, Kenneth Barr, to serve on a specific committee in as far as trying to find out the reuse of the Modern Art Museum in Fort Worth. It was a facility that was being vacated and needed to find out what we were going to do with it. I've served on the Mexican American Democrats. I serve on that board as a treasurer. I serve on the KERA Latino Advisory Committee, the Hispanic Salute Committee. I previously served on the Latin Arts Association board, on the Hispanic Chamber board. It's just so many. There's numerous, and again, like I said, I don't keep up with everything. I just don't. I just, if somebody needs my help and I see it as a worthy cause, then I'll help out, and I don't keep track. I really don't.
Can you tell us about what other positions you've held?
Right now, I'm vice president of the board of the Fort Worth ISD. Again, treasurer of the Mexican American Democrats, executive committee, previously the executive board of the Latin Arts Association. As far as political, this is, basically the school board. That's all I've done.
Currently you're the trustee of the Fort Worth Independent School District?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us what the trustee of the Fort Worth Independent School District actually does, what the jobs are that follow with that?
Creates problems, but not really. Our response is to oversee. I have 17, I have now 19, soon to be 20 schools in my district. I represent the north end of Fort Worth. And basically it's our responsibility to oversee the superintendent, for one, managing the schools and making sure that all the schools have the things that they need, the tools that they need in order to educate our children. It can be anything from budgets to bond elections, personnel, making decisions on personnel matters. It's a variety of numerous responsibilities that you have.
And would you mind telling us what is your salary for the Fort Worth Independent School District?
It's free of charge. There is no salary.
What is your current full-time job?
Well, right now I'm working part-time and I'm a legal assistant.
And are the rumors true that you might run for city council?
Oh, now who told you that rumor? Let's not look that way. I have been asked. I have not decided at this point, but I have been asked. And I am considering it.
And more in the view and opinions, but can we assume that you're bilingual?
Yes, I am.
And what do you think about the stereotype of people just automatically assuming that you're bilingual or non-Spanish speaking, or what is your opinion on that?
You know, it just depends on the situation itself. You know, again, nowadays, more so than none, you know, people do, you know, expect that you are bilingual and so forth. I guess it really, it bothers me at some point, you know, but in other times, it's, you know, I'm usually so busy and trying to do one thing or another. I think it's unfortunate that people automatically label you, which is wrong, you know. I don't agree with that. And there are certain people that are offended, you know, because they automatically assume that. But, you know, I'm proud of what I am. And if you want to talk to me in Spanish, you know, that's no problem. But I guess it goes with anything else. You know, it's a perception. And people automatically, you know, their use of the perception of whether to label you a certain way before they even get to know you, I think that's totally wrong.
And can you tell us what you think of bilingual education?
I think bilingual education, I'm in total support of it, okay? Because a lot of times, a lot of our children, like in Fort Worth ISD, we have a school where children come that they've never been in the setting of school. And that is their language, that their only language is Spanish. And so I think it's, I don't agree with the fact that you just, you know, put them in a classroom and you either sink or swim. I don't agree with that. And if that child's first language is Spanish, then we need to help them make sure that they are speaking it, you know, correctly. And then, you know, try to help them get into the regular mode of trying to learn the English language. But I'm supportive of bilingual education.
And what would you say is the major problem with the schools in Fort Worth currently?
The major problem is there's not enough funding. We do not have enough teachers. There's not enough. One of the concerns when talking with a lot of our parents, and I get this, is like, you know, they don't feel that there are enough teachers that can relate to them culturally. And that's one of the big problems. We do not have enough male teachers, for one. And you have to look at the fact that a lot of our students look at their teachers and they're not only a teacher, they are a counselor, they are a friend. And when someone doesn't have a positive role model or someone they can talk to at home, a lot of times our students latch on to the teachers and they look for guidance. And sometimes it's, you know, with some of our young men, some of the concerns that they have is the fact that they don't have a male counterpart that they can, you know, talk to and ask for guidance in whatever situation or problem that they're having. But most and foremost is the fact that we don't have enough funding to go around. And number two, like I said, the teachers are losing, a lot of them will lose the fact that they feel that they can't relate on a one-to-one to a student. The other thing is being culturally sensitive. We still need to work at that. We've gotten a lot better, but it's not to the point that we need to be.
Do you have any ideas how we could solve these problems in the school district?
Sure. We need to get more parents involved and be able to convince, well, actually fight a little harder. That's bottom line. We just need to fight a little harder to and being with the legislature and so forth to get the funding that we need. And so, and then also to convince the people that are in the positions that they need to stop looking through tunnel vision and look at everything, you know, in a wide open picture.
You said earlier that the students can relate better. I mean, do you believe that the students can relate better to someone that has the same background as them? For example, do you think like if Fort Worth ISD recruited more Hispanic or African American teachers, that can make a difference in?
Oh, definitely. But at the same time, the most important thing is the person wanting to lend an ear, you know. But yes, you know, culture has a lot to do with it, because if you don't understand the culture, then, you know, you've already got an obstacle in your way, you know. And it's like, it would be difficult to me, in my own personal opinion, it would be difficult for me to try to relate or to comprehend or understand some of the things, the barriers that you may be facing. You know, I haven't walked in your shoes, you know, so how can I begin if I don't get to know you on a personal basis and get to know a little bit about you and your culture? You know, and everybody says, well, you know, we're completely different. Well, if you look at the issues that are affecting everybody nowadays, and you look at the Hispanics, and let's say the African Americans, and even the Anglos, we are all worried about the same things. We all want the best education for our kids, you know. But at the same time, you have to be understandable and of their culture to help them overcome the obstacles that they're facing.
So, I mean, do you think also quality of teachers is an issue too?
Oh, definitely. And definitely.
What do you think the Fort Worth ISD can do to either recruit or make sure that people that are coming out of college with a teaching degree are equipped to actually teach?
With Fort Worth ISD, I will tell you that when I first got on the board, one of my biggest arguments and was that I felt that every time there was a group of teachers coming up for approval, and I will tell you that I looked, okay, let's see how many are Hispanic, you know, how many African American, and the response that we always got, well, they're not out there. Well, where are you looking? You know, are you going to the areas, you know, where the teachers are available and are there? And we're doing a lot better job now than what we were. We are spending a lot, I think, that we're doing as good a job as far as training and giving them the tools that they need, you know, to be better. One of the things that we've been doing is collaborating more with some of the colleges. This is what we're looking for, this is what we're needing, and this is what they need to have when they get out of the college, you know. And so we're working a lot better at that, but still, and looking at some of the statistics, there's not enough that are going into the teaching area. A lot of them are going into becoming the pharmacists in the medical field and lawyers, you know. And somebody could argue and say we have enough lawyers, you know. but you know, the fact is that we still need to have more teachers. And one of the things that I think we probably need to do is back, you know, when I was going to school, we used to have the Future Teachers of America. And I think that we need to go back and incorporate that again and train our teachers that, you know, live in the community. And so our students that live in the community want to come back to the district to teach in their communities because they would be knowledgeable of the geographical area, for one, and of the culture that's there in the students.
So now there's a disproportional rate of dropout amongst African Americans and Hispanics in high school. And what is Fort Worth ISD doing to solve this?
We've initiated several programs, and one of the latest ones that we did is we went to the business community and we said, we need your help. And so we've got, and that's another committee that I've served on, and we went to them to say, we need your help, you know, we need to be able to get, you have a lot of professionals that are out there that could come back and serve as role models or mentors. I'm also assisting in another committee that's actually another national committee that's coming together, and although we are in the planning stages to look at the way of obstacles that are out there, and the most important thing is that we have to educate our parents. You know, if there's not one community that you don't go to where the parents aren't knowledgeable of the fact that school district get ADA, which is, you know, attendance, they get monies for the daily attendance. And when you look at it, one of the factors that that hurts is the fact that, and I'll say this as far as Hispanics, our people are very hard-working people, they're very humble. They work very hard to try to make ends meet. Our people go to work at 4 o'clock in the morning, they go to work at 5 o'clock in the morning, they get home at 6, they get home at 7, they get home at 8. And usually there's no one there at home in the morning to encourage the kids to go to school. As a parent, you hope that they do go to school, but if there's no one there, you know that if there's not anyone there to encourage you and tell you get up and go to school, it's probably not going to happen, or they get to school late or whatever. That's one of the big factors. But at the same time, you cannot blame the parents because they're out there trying to do the best they can to put food on the table. You know, so, I mean, it's one of those damned if you do, damned if you don't situations, but the point of the matter is that we need to educate our parents to let them know how important it is for that child to be in school. So we're looking at, we have different areas. For example, if we have a student that may have gotten behind in some of their credits, we offer a school where if they've got like 16 or 17 credits and, you know, they're still a senior or they haven't gotten out, we have a school that's available. It's called Success High School. And where, if they need to work, they can go to work during the day and then go to school at 3:30 in the afternoon till about 10 o'clock at night. And then we have all the different programs where they can get caught up with their credits and kind of test out. And they still get their diploma. We have, again, with this mentor program, we've brought in all the community agencies together, and we've brought in the business community together, and we've just basically told the whole community, the city of Fort Worth, we need your help, and this is what we need to do. So those are all in the process of putting stages together, I mean programs together, and additional resources to be able to assist you know, our children, you know, to get to school.
Now, you said this Success High School is, I'm assuming it's alternative to,
Well, actually, it started out as an alternative school, and now, as a matter of fact, we are awaiting from the Texas Education Agency as to whether to make it, we have the permission to make it just a full four school.
Okay. Now, do you believe that there needs to be, do you think that the way schools are run need to be revolutionized in order to teach kids? I mean, because the way schools are being run now, it seems like they're not fulfilling their commitments.
I would say you can't continue teaching the way you've always been teaching, because then you'll always get what you've always gotten, right? But to me, and one of the things that I look at is, if you have a teacher that is not pulling out the creativity, you know, of that child, then you're going to lose them. And you've got to be able to reach in and get their attention. And if you have to be creative in the manner that you're teaching, well, then that's what you need to do. You know, and although that may work for some and not for the other, but there's all sorts of avenues that you can take. And to me, whatever works best in your classroom, that's what you need to do. That is my own, that's my personal opinion. So yes, if you have to, you know, change everything, then that's what you've got to do.
Okay. Earlier you said, as a member of the Fort Worth School Board, that one of the school board's responsibilities is to oversee the budget.
Mm-hmm.
And within this past year, there have been budget cuts, mm-hmm. You know, throughout the state. And what is Fort Worth ISD doing to overcome these budget cuts? Or are they reducing certain programs or eliminating certain things?
As a matter of fact, we are in the process right now, and we've had several meetings, and basically and I feel sorry for the superintendent, because he gets it from all ends, and you know, as a board member, he says, well, you're not cutting this out or you're not cutting that out, but we do have to look at all the programs that are there, and we need to look at what's working and what's not. And yes, we are cutting different we have a list that's on the chopping block, so to speak, and we're looking at all of them to see how we can, you know, cut, and there may be a point that we may have to cut some staff also. We are looking at downsizing in different areas, and that's going out through every school district in the state.
Well, are you guys looking for any alternative places for funding, maybe?
Oh, yes. We're applying for numerous grants, and again, it's just as creative as you want to be. And I'll tell you that one of my babies is music and arts. And if I have to be creative as a board member on my own and go to someone and say, if you're having, you know, a function or whatever, and would you be willing to give a percentage of whatever admission comes in and donate it back to the school district? And, you know, I don't mind begging. I don't mind begging, as long as I don't have to cut a particular program. You know, so there's different ways of being creative. And again, you know, although the grant monies are down, the point is, just because people are saying they're down, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't apply. You know, you should apply any way that you possibly can, in any foundation or, you know, a list of philanthropists, you know, apply to them. You know, just don't shut down because, oh, there's no money. You need to find a way to get it.
Okay. Going back a little bit, now, as a member of the school board, do you guys meet every day? Is it a daily job?
No, we meet, normally we have two scheduled meetings a month. Sometimes we may have to have a third one, sometimes we may have to have a fourth one, but it's normally two board meetings. As a matter of fact, I have a meeting tonight, and that starts at 5:30.
And mm-hmm. Now you represent District 1.
District 1.
And what does District 1 encompass? Which part of Fort Worth is it?
The north, northeastern part of Fort Worth.
Okay, and now you're elected?
Yes.
By the district?
Mm-hmm, you're elected, yeah.
And now, at these meetings, I mean, what usually occurs at these meetings? Is it just, is there an agenda, or is it like a meeting where people come and just express their wishes? Or
well, we have two types of meetings. Actually, sometimes we may even have, again, you may even have three. We have two that you have an agenda that's set in place, and you will discuss personnel. You will discuss purchase of properties if necessary. If there is an employee grievance that has been filed, again, then you have to, you know, it's like a mini hearing. You have to listen to the witnesses or whatever the grievance is. And then programs. For example, you may have a program that you need to find out and see if it can be funded, and if the board agrees to it, then there's a set of agenda items. We have one meeting a month where it's just a committee meeting where people come in, and you don't necessarily have an agenda, but people can come and talk to the board whatever concerns they may have. And we also have community meetings in different quadrants of the city at different high schools or middle school, where it's just an open community forum, sort of an open mic type of thing. People can come in and basically the superintendent give them an update as to what's going on in the district and so forth, and then if anybody, you know, has questions. We do not discuss personnel matters at those community forums, but we discuss, you know, general concerns about the education. It may be something with the building or you know, lack of a desk or whatever that may be, or a change in policy. You know, we have, it's an open mic type of thing.
Okay. Now, this time I'd like to change the topic. Now we're gonna go to your views and opinions, and I'm gonna hand over the question to Andrew Hill.
Hi. Sorry. In Fort Worth today, there doesn't seem to be a terribly unified Hispanic force. This city seems rather fractionalized. Mm-hmm. Somewhat compartmentalized. Economic development is sporadic. It stops in places like the Stockyards and traditional tourist destinations. It doesn't go much beyond that. Why, in your opinion, is that?
I really don't have a specific idea. I don't know.
Chad, why has the past 10 years, say, failed to produce a cohesive?
You have to understand that in times before, Fort Worth has always been known to be a good old boy type of society, and people have always seen that to be a problem, putting up the obstacles for minorities.
Yeah.
It has changed somewhat, but it has not gotten to the level that it should be. And again, you know, the Hispanic Chamber has played a role in that, in trying to bring in more individuals that are coming in and opening their own businesses and so forth. But there kind of had always been a pattern in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that, I really couldn't go into you know, the specific details. I just haven't.
What do you think would be the best way to, say, sort of organize? Because you have, in the Hispanic Chamber, there's sort of a Chanel suit element,
mm-hmm.
that tends to contrast a bit with what you call the street element.
Mm-hmm.
Many of whom may have undocumented in their lives. Many of whom may be first and second generation.
I guess a good part of that goes back again when we were talking about earlier was perception of people.
Yeah.
You know, we are what we are. We all have different walks of life, but it doesn't mean we all don't want the same thing, which is a good quality of life.
Right.
And I guess to me, basically, there has to be the cohesive there, but it's not. It's not there.
Right.
And I don't know what the solution is. Well, basically, probably to put aside personal agendas. I think you would start with that.
Yeah.
To put aside the personal agenda and look at people for what they are and help when you can't help.
Do you think it's by design? I mean, is there a conscientious effort, in your opinion, to fragment minority communities for essentially economic and political purposes?
I guess you could probably say that.
Yeah.
In any community.
Mm-hmm. think so.
That's probably true.
Yeah, the dominant structure doesn't
right.
have to see the power.
Right.
But do you think activism is dead, or?
No, I don't think it's dead. I think if you look at people, again, you know, trying to make ends meet on a day-to-day basis, that takes a major part of your time, you know, and a major part of your life. And a lot of people, even though they would want to be activists, don't find or can't find the time. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, everybody wants to be at it. I think that you would find people that want to be, you know, active. It's just a lot of times they're pressured and they can't, you know.
Yeah, I've thought a lot about this
yeah.
because there's huge swaths of undeveloped.
Well, and you know, when you sit back and you look at people when they tell you, well, you know, like I'm always says, you know, you really need to get involved, you need to do this. Well, Rose, I can't do that. Well, why? Well, you know, I've got kids or you know, I work, and I'm like, okay, mm-hmm. I work too, and
yeah.
I have kids. You know, but you have to look at what's important to you mm-hmm. and how badly you want to help to make things better. It's a personal choice, and a lot of people don't see it as an obligation. You know, I kind of see it as an obligation.
Yeah.
You know, and there have been numerous times that I've thought, you know, it's like the last time that I was up to run for the board. You know, when I first got on the board, I said, I'm not going to do more than 2 terms. No way, no how, no way. And then when the time came, it was like, well, you know, Rose, you have to, you know, and who are we going to put in your place? And you're already knowledgeable of this and this. And then you sit there and you think about it, and I mean, there's no glory to it, you know, and I don't like being put on a pedestal, and some people put you on a pedestal, but, you know, it's an obligation back to the community. You have, if you know that you can help in some way, then you should do it. But that's just my personal, you know, that's just my personal feeling.
What do you think, I mean, speaking of the community and disintegration and things like that, I mean, you're obviously involved through your work in a lot of family law situations.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen over the past 20 years in the Hispanic community a disintegration of family or a strengthening of it relative to?
I would say probably in my community, I would say probably 6 years ago or so, you saw the disintegration
mm-hmm.
of the family unity. I mean, it was just, it was awful. Again, you know, in one of the law firms that I work for, they did family law, and it was just awful seeing the amount of divorce cases coming forward, you know, for separation. And a lot of times, my own personal opinion is, it was all over material things. The division of the family was over material things, which is sad. You know, it wasn't, you know, anything else other than, you know, that was, you know, maybe somebody having an affair or something like that, but it was over material things and just choosing not to sit down and communicate with each other to work things out. It was just like, there's no way and that's it.
Yeah.
You know, and I thought, well, this is an alarming rate that they're coming in here. You know, so many, you know, within a week's time, and then you look at the numbers and within a month's time, you know, it was unbelievable the amount of people that were just, it was no big deal to go to the courthouse and get a divorce.
Yeah.
You know, and that's frightening, you know. And I mean, I was raised in the era where, you know, my mother says, do you understand that when you get married, it's you know, for better or for worse, remember that always. You know, so if it gets bad, too bad, you're staying in there. You know, and nowadays you don't see that. It's like, you don't like the way he looks one day, I see ya, you know.
Yeah. Yeah,
you
yeah,
know,
yeah.
And what's up with that, you know. I mean, you know, that's not right. You know, when you go into a marriage, there are no guarantees that your marriage is going to work out. I remember when I got married, I thought, God, well, I'll make it to the first year. That was scary, you know, but you have to work at it, and you have to build on that foundation. And that's what you know, you tell your kids, you know, in a relationship, you build on that foundation. And sure, the honeymoon's going to be over pretty quick, but that doesn't mean you give up.
Mm-hmm.
You don't give up. It's like anything else. You sit on a board. Yeah, you may want to strangle the person across from you because they don't agree with you, but you've got to work at that relationship and get them to understand your point of view. You know, and with anything, you have to work together. And I think that there's not enough of that goes on today. It's just too easy. It's too easy to dissolve a marriage nowadays.
Yeah, I think it. I mean.
And the sad thing about it is, you know, it's not the adults that get hurt. if there's children involved, they're the ones that get hurt. And then we're the ones that see it on a daily basis at the school level. Mm-hmm. Because we see what's tormenting that child.
Right. As a minority, mm-hmm. It's a little similar vein, but a different deal. It must, to see a good old boy network mm-hmm. robbing a school district blind mm-hmm. in a lot of cases, must anger you.
Definitely.
How do you put aside your anger to work with within that framework? How do you put aside your personal feelings to deal with the Ray Weldons of the world?
It's not easy. No. It's not easy. It's unfortunate, not only for the children that are without the funds for the necessary programs, but it's unfortunate for that person as an individual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's you know, in the school district, you have all these employees, you have over 3,000 employees, and you have some in the different areas of management and so forth, and you have to trust them, first and foremost, you have to trust them. And when you have the trust, and you know that the person is capable of doing what's right, and then for all of a sudden, for something to come out negative, it's like you've been raped.
Yeah.
It's basically it. It's like you've been raped, you know, your values and your trust.
Yeah, just a complete violation.
Exactly, a complete violation of your trust and as a person. And it's difficult.
What gives you the I guess, courage to somehow find faith in the system again after something like that?
Well, it's like anything else. You know, if something goes wrong, you have to sit back and look at what happened and find a way to correct it, and then find a way to convince your constituents that, you know, and admit if you made a mistake, you made the mistake, and, you know, we're going to correct it.
Yeah.
And, you know, with this turmoil that I'm assuming you're talking about everything that's going on with the district, well,
yeah.
we've got our jobs cut out for us.
Yeah.
You know, and there's no way to point the finger just at one individual, you know. And again, it goes back to the trust factor, you know.
There are some pretty egregious.
Exactly, yeah. And so we just have to work hard at it, and we're going to regain the trust.
Mm-hmm.
We are. There may be some people that may not be there, but again, I'm one person on that board, and we all have to come together to do what's right for all the children of all 80,000 children of Fort Worth ISD and with the taxpayers.
Mm-hmm. And that was, I guess, what I was kind of wondering is what internally drives you to be able to, is it a faith in humanity? Is it a capacity for forgiveness? Is it a belief in the overall arching structure, you know, the overall worth of what you're doing? What allows you to make the sort of compromises necessary to make?
Probably, I would have to say still the faith in humanity. There are still some good people out there.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of times, one of the things that is so hard is when you hear individuals say, well, you know, I kind of knew what was, you know, that there was a possibility, but, you know, we're just the little people and we can't say anything. Well, that's wrong. You have a voice.
Yeah.
You have a voice. Irregardless of who it is, you have a voice. And you need to, you know, let that voice be heard. If, you know, people continue to keep a voice down and not say anything, well, then, you know, things will continue happening the way they've been happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the faith in humanity would be there.
Yeah, you believe in someone struggling for the little person.
Exactly.
The voiceless. Mm-hmm. How do you give in a community, a number of your constituents are undocumented.
Mm-hmm.
Marginalized, living outside, but they want a better life for their children. They want the children to have an
mm-hmm.
education. Given that there's an intrinsic level of disenfranchisement there, how do you give them a voice most effectively, in your opinion, within today's political framework?
I put myself in their place.
Okay.
Yeah. Bottom line.
And just advocate for them.
Exactly. It's irregardless of where they come from. They're
yeah.
still human. They're still here.
Yeah.
They're working. they're paying their taxes. They're doing the same thing that you and I are doing. You know, it just so happens that they're undocumented. And the way I look at it is, you know, if nobody cares that they're undocumented and they're here working, they're building our roads, they're building our homes, they're building our cities. Mm-hmm. You know, what does that matter? You know, they just, again, it's the quality of life. And those, irregardless, you know, they're people, they're human. And they deserve to be treated with dignity and respect, just like anybody else. So what you would expect.
I was just wondering how we give them more of a political voice.
Well, and then there is a way still to have, you know, when they come forward, for example, I'll talk with a lot of the parents in some of the schools and like, you know, and they'll tell me in Spanish, well, miss, you know, we don't have the right. I said, why not? Well, you know, because we don't vote and we don't, I said, so? You are living in this community and you have a child in this school and you have a right to the respect, again, and the dignity, and you have a right, you know, to want the things that are good for your child just like anybody else, the same thing I do. So you have a voice. And I'll tell you, in one of the things, one of the most difficult things that just really infuriated me is when we were doing a bond election and we were trying to decide what area of town they were going to start with or whatever, you know, to start the building process and so forth. It was like, well, you know, the people in this area don't vote. And so, you know, we really can't, I said, excuse me? It doesn't matter whether they vote or not. They still live in that community and their kids still go to that school. So you treat them the same way as you treat anybody else. Mm-hmm. You know, and basically, of course, I always said, well, you know, if you're going to start right, you start with District 1 because I'm number one, so we go first, you know. That was my argument. But to merely say that someone doesn't deserve something because they don't vote, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, it really is.
You know, that is ridiculous.
How do we get, on a somewhat partisan level, given that I'm kind of a dyed-in-the-wool Democrat, how do we get to the point where the Democratic Party, in your opinion, in Texas, revitalizes itself and is able to reach out to the minorities who have been its core constituency for the past quarter century in order to make sure that those concerns are addressed?
It's difficult. I'd have to really think on that one. I'd hate to say something that wouldn't be right. you know, we're all going to have to work at it, really.
Yeah.
Just and basically, and my own opinion as far as with some of the Democratic Party is, you had a lot of people. Like, for example, this last race. You had a lot of people that were, catered to and given false promises and
mm-hmm.
so forth.
Yeah.
And now it's going to be interesting to see, you know, how they fell for it. And we're not really sitting back and looking at the issues.
Yeah.
You know.
And
it goes back to, again, to the education of the parents, you know, the voting people,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Producing literate.
Well, that's part of it also, but at the same time, you know, again, to take the time to get involved in what's going on, you know, and it's not, and I will say this, that it's not just the undocumented. It is not that it's people like you and I that don't get involved.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like we're illiterate, we can read, but it's taking the time to be interested in what's going on around you. Don't get upset after it's already happened. Get upset before it's happened and look at the issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Do you think that it's too fragmented?
Could be.
Do you think, I mean, because Fort Worth at least, you have a black constituency, you have a Hispanic constituency,
mm-hmm.
you have whatever constituency Mike Moncrief represents. I'm not sure they're...
The West side.
Yeah, I mean, the West side, you know,
mm-hmm.
I wasn't quite sure how to characterize them,
mm-hmm.
but it's hard to imagine, you know, a Rivercrest socialite and a Northsider and somebody from Arlington, you know, Como, all getting together around a similar issue.
Why couldn't we?
Nowadays. I'm saying I can't imagine it now. The party seems too fragmented. There's too many different concerns. How do you find a voice and a purpose? What would you, if you were planning a platform,
mm-hmm.
what would you have the party's central defining mission for, say, the next election cycle be? Something to rally around.
Well, the most important one would be the education. Mm-hmm. Because it doesn't matter what side of town you come from. Mm-hmm. You know, you either address the issue or you don't, because later on down the line you're gonna have to deal with it socially.
Okay. And
I have no problem in picking up the phone. You know, you have several people say, well, you know, you can't call him, why not?
Yeah.
Well, you know, he's not gonna talk to you, or they're not gonna talk to you, well, why not? You know, they're not a god, they're a person just like you or I.
Right.
You know, so you call them to the table and you sit down, and if they don't want to talk to you, well, it's their loss. Mm-hmm. Because later on down the road, they're going to need to talk to you in some way, shape, or form.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
You'll definitely see them.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah. What do you think is broken about, I mean, obviously the Texas state education system has a lot to be changed.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think is the most broken thing about it?
Oh, God.
Is there a glaring sore anywhere?
Not that I can... I'm sure there is. I'm sure there is, but not anything that's just kind of a daggering sore in me right now.
Like funding inequality.
Well, funding definitely is the big, and inequality. Well, you're right. It would be funding inequality, because the funding is a big issue again throughout the state, and not necessarily just throughout the state, throughout the nation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that funding is a big problem. I mean, I can call somebody in California; they're having the same problems. You know, you can call somebody in New York, and they're having the same problems. And the equity again. If people would just look at individuals as individuals and not as a specific group, and just look at their own selves, for example, what would you want for your kids? It's the same thing anybody else wants. You know, and if they would do that, we probably wouldn't have a problem with equality. But there's still, the mentality is still there to separate the people.
How do you somehow convince, though, Highland Park Independent School District, to take a local example, how do you take those parents who are paying through the nose in property taxes, that they have an obligation, a human obligation, almost noblesse oblige, to support a district in Mejia, or, you know, Deep East Texas, or Far South Texas, or bring a school to Ocalaya? How do you overcome those objections? Is there a way to do it, or does the state just have to step in and say, this is how it's going to be?
Irregardless of which way you choose to do it, they're mm-hmm. probably not going to be happy, so the state probably just needs to step in.
Okay, that makes sense.
That's the way I would look at it.
Yeah. I've now been informed that there are more questions I must ask you. Okay. What is leadership, in your opinion?
Somebody standing up for the rights of others.
That's good. I like that. Who is the most effective Mexican-American politician operating today? And you can pick a national and a state.
The most effective.
Local.
The first person, and well, there's several. There's several people that I admire, and again, it goes back to people stepping out, you know, for the rights of others. And again, you know, Jose Angel, I mean, he's, you know, the things that he's done is unbelievable. And you know, to have the courage to do what he's done, you know, Roberto Alonso, for one. You have Leticia Vandeput. For one, she has just kind of stormed in there, and although, you know, she's from San Antonio, Henry Cisneros, that was one, you know, he was one that came to our district several years ago, and it was interesting because, you know, he had a talk with me, and he says, Rose, he goes, this is where it all starts in PTA, and, you know, he goes, there's this rocket coming, and if we don't get on it, we're not going to go anywhere. And I said, I don't have any political aspirations, And he says, well, that's what you say now, but, you're on the road to it. I didn't take him too seriously, but, everything he was saying was true, that we had to step up to the plate. And I guess about 2 years later, 2 or 3 years later, that's when I wound up running for the school board, and I had an opportunity to go to Washington. Well, I got to meet up with him. And he said, so you took my advice, which was, it was good to, number one, that he remembered me, number two was that, you have someone at that caliber, taking the time to instill in you, some of the pride of how it feels to take, again, to be there for the rights of others, to fight for the, for the causes that are there. And so he was very, I took it that he was very instrumental. I mean, there's so many. Louis Zapata, for example, who was the first city council person, Hispanic city council in Fort Worth. There's numerous times that I go to him for advice, and I'm like, hey, I'm, this is going on, and, can they help me out here, And again, he's a mentor, And he's been very instrumental, in doing a lot of things that, that happened in Fort Worth.
Any eyes on his seat?
I've already been asked that question. The answer is the same. I'm thinking about
I'll
it.
I'll review the tape.
Okay.
Of all of the Mexican-American political organizations that are still in operation, what in your opinion is the most effective in terms of organizing and political advocacy?
I think the some of the LULAC districts and chapters have done a good job in continuing with that organization for so many years. It's one of the oldest organizations, and I think they've done a pretty good job. Again, it's like anything else, sometimes there's some that get disenfranchised and so forth, but overall, I think they've done a good job.
Do you think there's
go ahead.
I was just going to say, do you think there's a danger, like LULAC had, it faded, and then it kind of came back, and it kind of faded again, and became entrenched and complacent. Is there a danger in established organizations becoming complacent? Resorting to, rainbow push style, corporate shakedowns and rubber stamping, tokenism, things like that. To use like eight loaded words.
Do you like eight loaded words?
One sentence.
Probably. But, the things that you described, that goes on with anything.
Yeah, I'm saying, that's organizational behavior.
Yeah, that goes on with anything, and not necessarily just in the Hispanic organizations.
Yeah, any entrenched.
But, again, I guess it just depends on the, to me, it would just depend on the individuals and their desire to, to keep it, at a even playing field, steady field,
You think you fight the temptation by getting more fresh blood involved in things like, PTA meetings and things like that?
Well, it's always good to get fresh blood because then you have new ideas and new creativity.
Just kind of push.
And more energy.
Yeah, which is...
Because every now and then we need a little rest.
It does tend to... there's more here. The most pressing issue, in your opinion, facing Mexican Americans?
Education. Education.
And why do you think, why has it gotten to that point, in a nutshell?
Again, you have to go back and you have to look at each individual, community, in a sense. Our people are so, committed, number one, to their jobs and to making the ways to make ends meet. And then it becomes a little bit easier for a lot of our kids to not show up for school, and then it gets easier just not to go back, and then they lose out and they drop out, and then therefore it creates the problem of them having to take the mediocre jobs and not ever being able to advance.
Right.
And so...
And two generations or three generations,
yeah,
of mobility slides.
Well, it was okay for them, you know, I can do the same thing.
Yeah.
And we all need to take a look at that differently and instill in them, you know. You know, we have pride, but yet there's a different sort of pride when it has to come, you know, with, you know, your jobs and so forth. And for example, a lot of our generations for now that maybe didn't have a high school diploma, and they're at the point now where it's difficult for them to get a job.
Yeah.
Because they don't have the high school diploma, or they don't have the GED, they don't have the degree.
So things like GED classes and increased funding to colleges.
Additional funding, yeah, and either.
Yeah.
You can't do anything without having the funds,
mm-hmm.
you know, bottom line.
Would you say that's the first big deal, is getting more money flowing to these programs?
Not necessarily just more money, but to be able to have the right programs
mm-hmm.
that fit the particular community.
Okay, and that's a community by community.
Exactly.
Based. Yeah. Mm-hmm. How would you?
Because you just can't take a blanket and say, okay, everybody's got to do this, because it's not going to work.
Yeah. But how do you? I mean, in a society, how organizationally do you implement something like that?
Well, you have to, you have to go back and you have to look at that community itself and see, you know, what the obstacles are, and then you cater to that particular community.
Yeah.
You know, for example, if you have a community let's say, for example, they don't have a high school diploma, okay, and let's say, well, we can get you in this program, there's a GED program here, but what if that GED program is just in English and they don't understand the English language? So you would have to have, you know, you would create classes of bilingual GED classes, you know, and so if, you know, and that's going to help them, and then you transition them into the English language, you know, but you got to start once, you know, one step at a time.
I was just thinking, I mean, you could almost organize sort of a block captain type program.
Well, one of the things that we're doing in Fort Worth ISD is we have these, they're called Century 21 Centers. It's a federal grant. That we were able to obtain, and we've housed them at the middle schools. So it's sort of like a community evening school, and so not only do the students get to come back to the school to take, you know, classes of art or sculpting or whatever, but there's also room for the parents to take keyboarding, you know, to take, again, the bilingual GED classes, financing, you know, how to create a budget, how to work within a budget. You know, it just depends on that community, what their needs are, and how you tailor that specific grant or program.
Yeah.
Let's begin to wrap it up, please.
Okay. Last question, then. There are, there's some tension, apparently, between the Black and Hispanic communities, according to this question. What, in your opinion, would be the cause of that?
Agendas.
Yeah. Conflicting agendas.
Conflicting agendas or personal agendas. You know, that's with anything. You know. I mean, there's tension. There can be tension anywhere, you know, specifically. You know, again, it goes back to what personal agenda that you may have.
And now I have a few questions from the audience here. The first question is from Pam Bass. She'd like to know, when you're running for a school board, how much does it cost, and how do you raise the funds?
Okay. I didn't raise any funds until this last time, and I think I had like maybe $1,500. The first time I filed to run, there were two other people that had filed, and I filed like 10 minutes before deadline, and then the next morning, to my surprise, I found out that the other two removed their names from the list, and so they didn't run, so I got it unopposed. The second time I got it unopposed also. The third time I had an opponent, and so I raised, I think it was about $1,500 or $2,000, something like that. It was very minimal, I thought.
How did you raise that?
Just by, you know, calling individuals that I knew, and basically this, and a lot of the majority of them, they said, Rose, I know you've got an opponent. You know, here's a check, or here's some money, or here's $5, or here's $10. You know, I think the largest contribution I had was maybe like, they had a couple of $100, you know, but it wasn't no $5,000 or nothing like that. It was, you know, very minimal.
Okay. Pam also asks, did you run as a Democrat, or is there no party affiliation?
Well, Democrat, but there's really no party. I just did, but I'm, like I said, I've always been a Democrat.
Okay. Now, Jamal Clark would like to know, in relation to bilingual education, should it be working toward the mastery of English, or should it continue throughout the school experience through high school?
I would say probably, again, depending on the, you know, the student and at what level you get them in. You know, because it can go into high school, but you have to go towards a mastery of the English language.
How did you spend that $1,500 or $2,000? How did you win?
How did I win? Well, basically, and let me tell you a story about the last election. On the last election, I had a series of personal events that occurred in my life. My in-laws became very ill. And my mother-in-law, well, both, as a matter of fact, both my mother-in-law and father-in-law were in the hospital at the same time. And there was a lot of going back and forth. And right when we started the campaign, we're just putting, you know, having your yard signs printed, your mail outs and things of that nature, postage and all that. At the middle, sort of towards the middle, I kind of shut down the campaign, because it became too difficult to be going between two hospitals back and forth. And then at that time I made a choice that I had to make a decision. I was either going to be with my husband, you know, my family, or I was either going to campaign. And at that time I thought, well, you can always campaign, but you can't always be by your family members. And so I basically did not show up to very many community forums. I think maybe I attended maybe one or two, and that was it. And I got ridiculed in the newspaper that basically it was the tone in which the sentence was written. It's like, you know, Rose Herrera chose not to come to the debate or to the community forum because she had to be at her mother-in-law's, you know, rosary or some sort of fact like that. Because my mother-in-law passed away, she passed away, and we buried her the day before the election. And so I didn't campaign at all. And the morning of the election, I got up and my brother, my husband, my daughter, and friends got out and put out yard signs that morning. And then the election came forward and I won by like about 45 votes, I believe. Exactly 30 days later, my father-in-law passed away. So it was a very, very difficult, you know, time in my life. And again, and I made the choice. And at that point, I thought, hey, if I get it, I get it. If I don't, then it wasn't meant to be. And so, and I feel very proud of the fact that even though I didn't campaign, the people knew what I was about. And I was, my opponent was a retired school teacher. And I just feel that, you know, the community knew what I was all about, and they knew I was real. I wasn't, you know, somebody else that I was, you know, trying to be. You know, I was who I was, and they could relate to me, and I could relate to them. And so, in that sense, I felt, you know, blessed that, you know, I overcame those obstacles. And so here I am.
Fort Worth ISD is very unique, if not the only one that I know of, that the board chairperson runs for that office.
Yes.
In all the other school districts, the trustees select one of their own. Can you tell us the history of that or why that is?
We chose, well, actually, that was already in place when I got on the board, but that basically is the constituents chose that they wanted to select their own president versus having the person chose from among because of the politics. And so, and it's always been that way. And as a matter of fact, right now we're holding community forums because one of the board members put it on the agenda for a vote as to whether we wanted to decide whether we wanted to create another single member district or if we wanted to, just continue with, you know, the norm is electing the president at large. And so far we have two more community meetings that are left and where the people come in and voice their opinion, whether they want us to change it or not. But I will tell you, the sad thing about it is that even though there was an interest out there, we don't have very many people that will show up to the forums. We may have 10, we may have 15. I don't think we've had more than 25 show up at any one of those community forums expressing their opinion. And basically, the majority has been to keep it as is, to elect your own, I mean, to elect the president at large.
Will you tell us in the last bond election that you all had, the politicking behind closed doors inside there, you alluded to it by saying, I'm District 1, I come first, I get number mm-hmm. 1. How do you negotiate with the other 8 to get what you want, and what was it that you were trying to get?
We looked at the need. Basically, one of the things that I did is the need. The majority of my schools, and I have one of the largest district at that time, was the fact that we had so many kids that were in portable buildings and so forth. And we looked at the need of the buildings and what they needed to have done. And so they did a survey, and they went out and did an on-site visit of the different schools as to what was, you know, and we set them in categorical order, what was more pressing, what was not. And we just kind of came to an agreement among the board members. But it was a difficult situation. It was difficult.
How do you get 5 votes out of those 9? How do you do it?
Well, I just look at the issue, and then whenever the issue comes up in the board meeting, and you just, whatever the issue is, you discuss it, and then you kind of plead your case, depending on what the issue is. And you got to give good arguments.
Okay. Single member districts, can you tell us how that happened, when it happened, and why are they 8 districts? And
I couldn't even begin to tell you.
You just
it was already there when I was on.
Did you all just do redistricting again? Did you adjust the districts?
We did. Basically, we adjusted the redistricting this last time. When I first got on, there was only one. I was the only Hispanic on the board. And then there was a group of individuals that filed a lawsuit against the school district wanting or asking for an additional seat, an additional Hispanic seat. That lawsuit was settled, which at that time we created a committee to take or interview the prospective people that wanted to come on board, which resulted in Rachel Newman being accepted as the person to fulfill that seat. And then the following year she ran for that board. And then she chose not to run the next time around. And so then we had Juan Rangel that came on and got elected to that position. Jesse Martinez, his position was in the southwest side of town. And basically when we did the redistricting, we looked at the numbers and we tried to keep them at least at about, you know, a little over 60% of minorities in the different geographical areas.
Can you explain your position on school finance? That's going to be an issue now, again,
mm-hmm.
this so-called Robin Hood plan?
How can I say this? The state needs to take a look. Again, you know, you're going to have a lot of school districts that are not very happy with this Robin Hood plan, but at the same time, you have to look at the tax base. If you have a community, for example, let's say in the north side, you know, the majority of the homes, you don't get a lot of money from that tax base, from that particular area. And if you have an area, a demographic area, that has a greater tax base, well, what is the problem? If you're going to have to deal with the education of these students some way, somewhere along the line, what is the problem in just putting it in the pot and just dividing it equally? I don't see a problem in that. I mean, do you want to build more schools or do you want to build more prisons?
Your school superintendent exceeded the tenure for most superintendents. They always come and go within 2-3 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very hazardous position. What makes him so good, and what do you all do to keep him?
Well, one of the things when we first got our superintendent is, and one of the things that we looked at is in the past, and again, this goes back to my personal opinion, there was an equity issue there, and where we felt that a lot of students were not being given the opportunities that they needed. And it was always having to fight for that bone. It was always having to fight for the bone. And when we interviewed Dr. Toko, one of the things that interested the most was that he didn't see you know, he didn't feel that he needed to see the color. It was what was needed for the education of those children. And I think that was pretty much a lot of things that convinced the board. And he's done a great job. He came in, he did what we asked him to do. Our test scores have risen. There's, you know, we have been given more, the minorities have been given more an opportunity than they've ever had in the past in the history of Fort Worth ISD. And basically, how do we keep him? Well, he gets paid pretty well.
What is his salary?
He gets paid pretty well. With perks and all that, you're looking at probably pretty close to about almost 300. About, I think it's about 300,000, close to that.
275.
What's almost 300,000?
Yeah, it's very close.
Yeah, very close, you know, with all the different perks.
That is close.
But you have to look at the, you know, the responsibility also. You have 80,000 students, you know, and, you know, the gentleman says 274,000, but still, you look at the perks and all that; they're there. You know, he's done a good job. I cannot complain. Is he going to stay? We don't know. We'll find out. His contract is up this next year.
Under site-based management, you mentioned it. If you're not a citizen, you can belong. You can be part of that council. But under normal conditions, you have to be a citizen to vote and be on the school board. Would you be in favor of residents being eligible to vote?
Why not?
Is that a yes?
Yeah. I mean, why wouldn't they? You know?
Well, they're not allowed now.
Well, no, but the thing is, they can come in here and work and again, build our cities and all that. They should be able to.
You're a state officer in the Mexican-American Democrats' mm-hmm. treasurer. Mm-hmm. Can you explain to the class or us what the problem is between Mexican-American Democrats and Tejano Democrats?
Do I know what the problem is? No, I do not. And the only thing that I can look at that is that I think there was some problems in the past, and I'm not going to look towards the past. I'm going to look to the future.
What is the future for Rosa?
I have no idea. It's whatever comes into my place. Do I have higher aspirations? It just depends on what's delivered to my door.
Anybody else? Identify yourself and ask the question.
The people that Pam Bass,
uh-huh.
The people that you said should be able to vote, do they pay taxes?
Yeah, I'm sure they do, the majority of them.
So they come
yeah, there are some that do not.
Our buildings, do they pay taxes?
Well, do they take taxes out of their payroll checks?
I don't know. I'm just asking.
I think they do. Or the ones that I know of, they do. Yeah. You know.
Any other questions?
Well, then, on behalf of the Mexican American Politics class here at UT, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me, and I hope I was of some help to you guys.